Funding for The Connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. At the close of the Vietnam War a quarter century ago, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger led the chorus against recriminations on U.S. policy, recriminations that would have been directed significantly against him. But in the new century, our guest, the journalist Christopher Hitchens, argues that it's time to review not the questions of policy, but the evidence of war crimes, most pointedly against Kissinger, who had been Richard Nixon's virtual co-president where Indochina was concerned. If Pinochet of Chile and Milosevic of Serbia can be indicted for war crimes, crimes of state, why not Henry Kissinger, he asks. Connection listeners, if you remember Vietnam, be reminded of the four-year Kissinger-Nixon extension on it from 1969 to 1973. If you didn't experience Vietnam, be introduced again for the first time to the secrecy and cynicism and destruction of that war. Twice the bomb tonnage than was dropped in all of World War II. Hundreds of thousands of Laotians and Cambodians killed who were never in the war. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. Is Henry Kissinger's record the record of a war criminal? 1-800-423-TALK. Christopher Hitchens is the British-born gadfly in the Washington press establishment. His indictment of Henry Kissinger is appearing serially in Harper's Magazine this winter. Christopher Hitchens' last blast in hardcovers and on The Connection was directed at President Clinton. The book was called Nobody Left to Lie To. Christopher Hitchens, I've read these articles with great interest. They're not exactly a legal brief, but they're not a spoof either, I take it. You're serious?
I didn't hear the last bit. I'm awfully sorry.
Well, I say it's not exactly a legal brief here, but it's not a joke either. You're not jesting.
Oh, good grief. No, I was never more serious in my life. I understand you correctly now. I got fed up of people saying in sort of conversational or cocktail party ways, oh, I saw that old war criminal Henry Kissinger the other day, or you're saying as if it was a matter of fact observation, you know, Henry Kissinger's committed crimes against humanity. Because it began to strike me that, in fact, that was literally true. And as I've watched the international law and the law of war and on human rights evolve over the last couple of years, it's struck not just me, but as I point out in the introduction to my Harper's piece, it struck Henry Kissinger himself that he is a vulnerable man, that he too may be within the reach of international law. And I can give you some examples if you like.
Well, sure. You think he's vulnerable even against vulnerable to disclosure by the U.S. government of, for example, his machinations in Chile. That's one episode. Let's talk, though, as you do in the first Harper's piece, most especially, about Vietnam. What is the in the modern world, the world of Pinochet and Milosevic, what's the vulnerability, do you think, of Henry Kissinger?
The vulnerability of Henry Kissinger, where in a world where Pinochet is already on the verge of going to jail and has lost his sovereign immunity as a former head of state, where Mr. Kissinger's former clients and friends and political allies in Indonesia, where he was a great prop and stay of the military dictatorship and helped materialize the genocidal invasion of East Timor. In Greece, which was a dictatorship during his time as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. In Bangladesh, all these people are in jail now in their own countries and would probably have been jailed if they'd tried to leave those countries. That's how bad the company he's kept was. In the United States, the company he kept in the year 1968 was the following. Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, John Mitchell. Two of those guys did go to jail. The third would have gone to jail if not pardoned for crimes committed while in office. Kissinger remains in all these cases the unindicted co-conspirator. I'll try and summarize very tersely without loss of force what I think the gravamen is of the Vietnam matter. May I?
Please.
It's this. In 1968, as has now been, I think, definitively established, Richard Nixon, John Mitchell, and others conspired to subvert the Paris peace negotiations that were being conducted by President Johnson and Vice President Humphrey. It's amply documented now, and in my article I pull together all the different narratives that sustain that story. They did it in this manner. They went to the South Vietnamese military regime and said to them, if you pull out of the talks on election eve and sabotage, as it were, the peace plank of the Democrat Party platform, you'll get a better deal from an incoming Republican administration. And that the Tu regime in due course did do that on the very eve of the election, did ever afterwards behave as if it had a deal and an understanding with a Republican incoming administration, and was correspondingly much better treated. But the war was ended more than 4 years later on exactly the same terms that had been on offer in Paris at that time. So that the extension of this war is, so to speak, doubly criminal and doubly wasteful. And the point man in Paris itself for the Nixon team and reporting from inside the negotiations to them was Henry Kissinger, who, having met Nixon only once in his life, then as a reward becomes National Security Advisor and subsequently Secretary of State, and in that capacity not only prolongs the war to the tune of some 22,000 or so American lives, an untold number of Vietnamese, and extends the war to two neutral countries whose civilians are subjected to protracted, cruel, barbarous, indiscriminate bombardment across
the face. That's Laos and Cambodia. Laos
and Cambodia, personally supervised, not just generally supervised, but intimately, individually, and secretly conducted, without the knowledge of Congress, by Dr. Kissinger. These actually violate the laws of war as they were understood at Nuremberg. They certainly violate every subsequent human rights codicil, that the war crimes codicil that the international law community has been able to formulate.
There are several things here. I was intrigued that all of this stuff is sort of gruesomely familiar, and yet you bring it all back. Telford Taylor, of Nuremberg fame, warning the United States government that there was exposure here to the Nuremberg test, most specifically in the sort of willful endangering of civilians, and they were virtually all civilians in Laos and Cambodia. The numbers are horrific. 20,000 Americans died in that further 4 years of the war. 100,000 South Vietnamese troops and 500,000 North Vietnamese troops, but you also remind us close to 1 million lives, it may be more, in the raids into Laos and Cambodia. Make the point, as you would if you were prosecuting the case, that the raids into Laos and Cambodia violated not only the law, but the kinds of insistence that we had brought to bear on France, for example, when they were not allowed to pursue Algerian rebels into Tunisia.
Yeah, the United States claimed, or the Nixon-Kissinger gang, rather, that was then, to our eternal shame, representing the United States government, tried to make the case that this violation of Cambodian neutrality and extension of a war that they privately knew was lost, that's the thing always to bear in mind, they never said we can win this war. They were trying to save their own faces using other people's lives as cover, as smokescreen. Bear that always in mind, because that can be documented. They claimed the right to violate Cambodian neutrality on invoking the principle of hot pursuit. In other words, we have an enemy in one country. Bad enough, you might think, that they were already embroiled in Vietnam. This enemy would not elude us if it didn't have sanctuaries, as they were called in Cambodia. So we're going to cross the Cambodian border and flush them out there. That was the supposed logic of the intervention. Well, the United States had, ever since the founding of the UN and the proclamation of the UN Charter, denied to all its allies the right to that pathetic alibi, which obviously would mean any power could pretty much do anything it liked if it was allowed to become a precedent. They stopped the British and French and Israelis from invading Egypt and occupying the Suez Canal zone in 1956 on that basis. Adlai Stevenson told the British they couldn't defend their colonial rule in Aden by pursuing guerrillas into neighboring Gulf states, nationalist guerrillas who were fighting British rule there. And on another famous occasion, I think again it was the Eisenhower government, but it may have been an early Kennedy one, told the French that they had no right to pursue Algerian rebels into Tunisian territory and attack neighboring towns. So this was all well understood as a principle not to be violated before it was so egregiously violated by by Nixon and Kissinger.
So much of that war was, as you recount it, Shirley, but I, as I remember it too, was undertaken for sort of theatrical effect. It was done to preserve credibility, Kissinger told de Gaulle. It was done in the so-called Speedy Express offensive of early 69 to make a political impression. At enormous, I mean, the six-month clearance of the province of Kinhua was done not for strategic or tactical reasons, but for dramatic reasons, really. There were also high-level bombings by B-52s, where pilots knew perfectly well that they couldn't see their targets and couldn't direct their bombs. How do you explain that, Christopher Hitchens? How do we all come to understand this in retrospect, 25 years of retrospect now?
Well, maybe it gives away my age, but I can remember how it felt watching it then, the helpless feeling that one had of seeing directly transmitted into one's home in some cases, or by the reports of friends in mine, people who'd been there either as journalists or as soldiers, of watching a sort of, as you say, a kind of grand opera of atrocity and misery being inflicted on this people and on this nation and civilization, and feeling not powerless exactly to stop it, because one always had the feeling that there would be enough Americans to say this can't go on, and that feeling turned out to be justified. But at the time, just the, as you say, the scale of it, and if you've ever seen a B-52 bomber, it's an amazing beast, and in order for it to fly, it has to get up very, very high, it has to move very, very slowly. You can't see it from the ground. I've talked to people in Indochina who, you know, they would be tilling the fields, and suddenly this rain of steel and fire would fall from the sky. They had no idea where it had come from, especially the people of Laos, who were barely in the 20th century as it was. They refer to it in their national story as, you know, the time when there was suddenly this terrible nightmare began to fall from the sky, and it went on round the clock for months and months, and they'd had no idea what they'd done to deserve it or what had gone wrong. It was as if nature itself had gone insane.
But how do you explain
They had to move and live in holes in the ground like animals. Many of them still do. The mines are still going off.
What was it in Henry Kissinger?
Every day in Laos, mines and bombs are still
going off. Yes, I grant you. But how in the world do we account for it in Henry Kissinger's mind?
Well, and here's the thing. No one's ever been to explain to those Laotians why that had to happen to them. But I have heard, and here are some other names that will be familiar to people of our age, and even some who are younger. I have heard Robert McNamara. I have heard William Colby. I have heard William Bundy. I have heard a number of other of the major American political establishment strategists and strategic thinkers of that time, and read them also, making atonement, saying, look, we admit it. We lied to the American public about this. We lied to Congress knowingly about it. We said that we were winning the war when we knew we were losing it. We said it had objective A when it had objective B. We looked unflinchingly at the casualties and thought they were worthwhile. And now we're really very sorry about it. And we also feel that we should donate such papers and records as we have to the records so that the history of this can be better told and better learned from. Some effort's been made. In other words, from Henry Kissinger, not a squeak. This is a man who still looks at all that misery and aggression and atrocity and pain, and thinks of it with pride.
Christopher Hitchens, stand by.
Enjoyed it at the time and relishes it still.
We'll be right back with Michael Scharf, who teaches international law, to consider seriously, as he wants us to, Christopher Hitchens' case that Henry Kissinger was a war criminal and ought to be tried. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Christopher Hitchens, in the current Harper's Magazine, makes the case that Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, ought to be tried as a war criminal for sabotaging the peace process in 1968 and then, under Richard Nixon, extending the Vietnam War for 4 years at a tremendous cost in life and treasure. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation on war crimes as they're being reconsidered in the 21st century.
Mr. Leiden?
Yeah, please.
Would you mind, it may seem greedy of me because you've been so generous in the way you've summarized what I've said about Indochina, but this is the first part of the two-part series, and the second part of this part, the one that's on the newsstands, also concerns Chile and mentions specifically a number of other instances.
We'll get to that. I just thought I would give people the impression
we were only going to talk about Indochina.
No, Central America, Cyprus. There was a whole world to waste out there. Bangladesh, too. 1-800-423-TALK joins the conversation. Now, I want to introduce Michael Scharf, who teaches international law at the New England School of Law and worked in the State Department under Bush the Elder and Bill Clinton. Michael Scharf, let's just be loyally here for a moment. Is there anything like a legal case here to be prosecuted against Henry Kissinger?
Let me begin by saying that anything I say should in no way be construed as an apologist for Kissinger's policies. I'm one of the greatest opponents of many of those policies. But Christopher Hitchens, in his article in Today, makes a very compelling moral case, but not such a great legal case. It's not as strong, and there are a variety of reasons for that. Just looking at the situation in Indochina that we've been talking about, and we can talk about Pinochet and the others later in the program, he's made two main points. One is that Kissinger subverted the peace process. This is not and never has been identified as an international crime. The second point, which is a tougher one, involves the bombing of Cambodia and Laos. And in particular, the allegation is that the bombing of civilian areas suspected of harboring guerrillas would have constituted a war crime. Even Telford Taylor, who had been a junior U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, in his book on Nuremberg and Vietnam, expressed real concerns about this policy. But if we look at it, the problems are as follows. The war crimes are defined under the Geneva Conventions, and in particular, the ones that are relevant would be purposely targeting civilians or causing extensive destruction of property not justified by military necessity. The problem with those is that it is not clear by the evidence that Nixon and Kissinger were trying to kill civilians because they were civilians. And they did make allegations that there was a military rationale for what they were doing. The issue comes down to who decides. And if you look at the recent NATO bombing in Yugoslavia as a case study, there were similar allegations. There were problems with the use of the depleted uranium, which has been a subject of your program, targeting the electrical and water generating plants and the radio operations. And a lot of countries in the world and a lot of human rights advocates took the position that these were war crimes. And there are many of the same voices that we hear saying that what Kissinger and Nixon did were war crimes. The NATO bombing was examined by the Yugoslavia Tribunal, a neutral body. And in a lengthy report that came out last summer, they said that there were no indictable offenses. And that raises the issue of who decides. If a U.S. court were to decide this matter, Kissinger would be acquitted. If the Yugoslavia Tribunal would decide it under its precedent, Kissinger would be acquitted. But if it was
I have to disagree with the second. I'm sorry, I'm following you very closely. You can't assume that about the Yugoslavian.
Michael, finish the point, and then we'll have at it.
But I'm saying if it were decided by Vietnam or an Asian court, there's a real good chance that there would be an indictment and a request for Kissinger's extradition using the precedent of Pinochet. And the Pinochet precedent is now one of just many cases where foreign courts are starting to exercise universal jurisdiction, often at the urging of the United States. And what's going to happen is that this urging is going to come back as a policy matter to haunt U.S. officials. And that's really the troubling aspect of what Christopher raises today.
Certainly, they didn't target civilians, but there was surely a reckless disregard for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths in this bombing.
No,
was there not? Doesn't that count?
No. Sorry? I think it could be. Well, first, I should thank you, sir. I thought that was a very good exposition indeed. I should also say that it's only in the second part of my series in Harper's that I get to the review of the current state of international law and review the various ways in which Mr. Kissinger is vulnerable. I certainly don't make the case now, though, that the subversion of the peace process in November of 1968 was a crime. It was a crime, by the way, under American law. The Logan Act specifically forbids private citizens from...
Right, but no one has ever been convicted under the Logan Act, and like Jesse Jackson have frequently flaunted it and done private negotiations.
I think you mean flout.
But
I think
contract.
The Logan Act prosecution could, if there was ever going to be one, this is the one that could be brought. Now, as to how knowledgeable or deliberate the Kissinger-Nixon duo were about civilian casualties, well, look, I can't summarize my whole article. I can only place it in evidence and say that anyone who reads the instances I give and can say, well, I wonder if they knew what was happening to the civilian population, I think would be a very credulous person. It's the point that Telfer Taylor makes is it doesn't really matter. What we have to show is, should they have known? That's what Japanese generals were executed.
Okay, now the problem with the
should they were they did they have command raising, did yes. they have operational command and control and communication?
Right, exactly.
Were they the answer to that is absolutely certainly they did.
Well,
and knowing what was happening, they went on doing it. So
okay, now certainly
the distinction you introduce is really one without a difference.
As commander in chief, the president has operational control, and the Secretary of Defense and the military commanders. But there is more precedent coming out of the Yugoslavia Tribunal in the Celibidze case, in which there has been a narrow interpretation of who has operational control for the theory of command responsibility. And it is unlikely, I think, that a Secretary of State or a National Security Advisor, simply for giving advice for being one of many voices in cabinet meetings that are discussing these issues, could be held responsible on that basis.
But as you will know, if you take another glance at my offering here, that's not the case with Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger took a very direct, day-to-day, personal, operational interest in the management of this war, in the selection of targets, in the naming of and selection of individual villages and hamlets. It seemed to be something for which he had a distinct relish. If you read what I depict of his time in office and compare it to the relevant paragraphs in Taylor as I lay them out, I think it's a pretty plain case.
Michael Sharth, let me just be clear in summing up. I want to go to phone calls, too. Are you saying basically that the trial of Henry Kissinger would depend entirely on the courthouse and the country that he got tried in?
Yeah, one of the big problems with these universal jurisdiction crimes, crimes like war crimes and crimes against humanity and torture and genocide, is that there isn't a tremendous amount of precedent out there. And therefore, there's a lot of wiggle room for interpretation. And as a result, it matters greatly who's going to be doing the deciding, whether it's the United States or an allied court that's been requested to extradite, or whether we're talking about a court from a country that is unfriendly to the United States. And there is so much discretion involved in these cases, I think the forum would dictate the outcome.
Stand by for the wisdom of the people. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation on Christopher Hitchens' indictment of Henry Kissinger for war crimes. Dan is on the line.
Hello, Christopher. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you,
on the
Dan.
Show. And thanks, Mr. Hitchens, for your body of work. I think you're a credit to your profession. I was going to ask you to comment, though they might pale in comparison, comparatively, on as far as sins go, on Kissinger and the U.S. role in the slaughter in East Timor in the early 70s.
I'll happily do that, though I'd be, in a sense, cutting my own throat, since that's in an as-yet-unpublished part two of Harper's, which we very much hope you'll all go and line up and buy.
That's whetting appetites, not cutting.
Shall I just say to anyone who is curious about East Timor, I know a lot of people are, that I think it's, by the way, it's the most clear and direct, probably, a case of advanced knowledge and complicity in a bloodbath against civilians, of the whole lot, and that's in a strong field of Kissingerian
atrocities. Included in the other things that are being spoken about, his role in the assassination of Allende and in Vietnam, it seems that the slaughter in East Timor and the current U.S. role in relationship with Indonesia is something that is perhaps more alive than the some of those other things in the past.
It also raises a related question, that of Kissinger's later profiteering from the political and military atrocities that he committed while in office. In other words, he's regularly been in receipt of huge streams of income from Indonesia since that time. And that's something else I think that would bear investigation. I don't directly talk about the murder of Allende in my article, but in part one, the one that's now before you, I do describe the individual role played by Kissinger in the assassination of General René Schneider, the head of the Chilean Armed Forces, who was a constitutional-minded officer who believed that the Chilean Armed Forces should stay out of politics. For this reason, he was selected for death. He was whacked. He was hit, as we would say if we were talking about ordinary criminals. And I lay out the case for considering Dr. Kissinger, as I shouldn't call him, Mr. Kissinger, as basically having taken part in a common or garden mob hit in the Schneider case.
Michael Scharf, you've read that. It's a dreadful story. Does it go over the war crime threshold?
Right. In that part of Christopher's article, he talks about the assassination of General Schneider and also of Letellier. And basically, as I understand the context here, is that recently in January of 99, Clinton ordered the release of all sorts of government documents that have indicated that Henry Kissinger knew of Pinochet's secret police. He knew that they were committing systematic torture and assassination of political opponents, in particular of General Schneider and Letellier. And there's a transcript of his 1976 visit to Santiago where Kissinger says to Pinochet, "The U.S. is sympathetic to what you're doing, and we approve of your methods." And so, and I don't want to put words in Christopher's mouth, but what you're basically arguing, I think, is that Pinochet saw this as a green light to proceed with the torture and killing, and therefore Kissinger should be indicted, what, under conspiracy theory or aiding and abetting? The problem is that for a conspiracy, there has to be an actual agreement between the two parties. This is what was intended, and this is what is desired as the result. And it's a little bit of a stretch based on the evidence that has been released, although there's certainly a lot that's still left to be declassified in CIA hands, to argue that Kissinger and Pinochet sat down and made a conspiratorial agreement to kill Schneider and Letellier. And for aiding and abetting, you have to show that Kissinger gave support with the intention that these specific acts occur. And okay, although he may have unwittingly given the green light to proceed with torture and killing through his words, is that so much different than what Jim Baker did when he went to Yugoslavia on the eve of the breakup and said, the U.S. does not have a dog in this conflict, and we
want... It couldn't be more different. I'd happily accept your challenge. There you have...
Christopher Hitchens.
There you have a case of what I must say, I think, in Mr. Baker's instance, is that of sort of moral nullity and cynicism. But what he basically says, we don't care what happens here. So far different in the case of Chile, where, if I may correct you, General Pinochet was not in power when General Schneider was murdered. What had happened was that the Chilean left had won the election, and its presidential candidate, Salvador Allende, was going through the 60-day interregnum that the Chile has constitutionally as the transition period. And the Nixon-Kissinger gang decided and said, we're not going to let this guy be sworn in. They were looking for a way of destabilizing the situation. The plan was this: get rid of the constitutionally minded General Schneider, who heads the Chilean Armed Forces. If possible, make it look as if it's the left that's had him killed, and create enough turmoil to justify a coup. That's the plan. That's not James Bakerian indifference, surely. The record shows, and I have all the minutes of the meetings, that they looked around to find the most extreme men of violence with the most extreme fascist politics and the most the longest record of conviction for crimes of violence that they could find on the fringe of the Chilean military and police world, found them, sent them illegal money to commission a hit, and sent them illegal guns that had their identities concealed through the American diplomatic bag.
Part of the Kissinger connection.
In order that they be used to kill, and I'll repeat this, a constitutionally minded officer in a democratic country which had just had a democratic election, with which the United States was not at war, and with which it maintained perfectly open diplomatic relations. There is no law that allows you to sit in Washington and commission that murder. If you do that, you're as guilty as if you had done it yourself.
I was going to say, Christopher Hitchens, that the Kissinger connection was the sort of theatricality of it. I mean, it was not, there was, it was a leftish government, duly elected, but the threat was a joke, as Henry Kissinger made famous. He said the, you know, a leftist government in Chile would be a dagger aimed at the heart of Antarctica, which is to say nothing, but they wanted to make a show, it sounded like.
Yes, it was an impudence that had to be punished, but it was also there were certain interests that needed to be paid back off. But look, I didn't quite finish with Mr. Shah's challenge on the other matter, the murder of Orlando Letelier, which, for those of your readers who don't,
in Washington,
excuse me, listeners who don't remember it, it's the only time a foreign government has ever been found to have detonated a car bomb or an explosive device of any kind in Washington, D.C., at Sheridan Circle at Rush Hour. That's on Embassy Row, quite near where I live, as it happens, in the fall of 76. And Orlando Letelier, former foreign minister of Chile, and then an important anti-Pinochet exile, and his American friend, Ronnie Moffitt, were blown apart, were destroyed by that bomb. And now we know everything about that crime. It's taken a very long time, and some exemplary work by the FBI, but now we know everything about who ordered that killing and every step that leads back to the order being given by Mr. Pinochet. And we also know who obstructed justice in making it take so long to find this out. And that's going to come up, I assure you. And there are also living relatives of other Chileans who are able to bring under the Alien Torts Claims Act
And what is the Kissinger connection other
civil
than
suits against it?
Kissinger's promotion to Pinochet?
Yes, now Mr. Shah mentioned the meeting in Santiago with Pinochet and Kissinger, where we now do indeed have the minutes, which I also reproduce in Harper's Magazine. And we have Kissinger telling this foreign despot not to worry about the U.S. Congress, telling him how he, Kissinger, can probably defeat Congress's plans to cut off arms to Chile and its torturing and murderous regime. And twice in this discussion, Pinochet threatens Orlando Letelier and says what a liar and what a nuisance and what a pest he is in Washington, D.C., and makes unpleasant references to him. Does Henry Kissinger say a word? No, he does not. And a few weeks later, a bomb goes off in the nation's capital, and an American citizen as well as a Chilean one are murdered. And the chain of collusion has been made now even more amply clear by the Hinchey report, which was only just delivered to Congress on the CIA's knowledge at that time when Henry Kissinger was the chair of the 40 Committee, which oversaw all covert operations.
Christopher Hitchens, stand
by. They were paying a subsidy to Manuel Contreras.
Stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Christopher Hitchens about his article in Harper's indicting Henry Kissinger for war crimes. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Connection listeners, we're all sort of in the grand jury. Would you be inclined to vote for the prosecutor Christopher Hitchens' indictment of the former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger? 1-800-423-8255 makes the war crimes connection. Chris is calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, what I'm curious to is what would Kissinger's motives have been, or perhaps more appropriately, what was the group of the conspirators' motives? I mean, obviously our country's motive was communism. We had to fight communism and the dominoes that were supposedly...
You there?
What do you suppose that was? Thank you very much.
Chris, thank you. There are many arenas in which you're indicting Christopher Hitchens, but how do you answer the sort of motive question? Christopher Hitchens?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether the allusion was to Vietnam and Indochina or whether it was to Chile. It certainly would be true that the overall justifying claim made for the committing of a number of these crimes was that anything was better than communism. I'd be perfectly happy to see that entered as a defense in a court that was trying the issue of whether they were war crimes or not.
Michael Schaff, do you want to talk about motives in this realm? I mean, everybody has a motive.
I understand that there are both political motives and maybe private motives behind some of these actions. And I'm not sure whether the motives themselves are what's important to the legal issue here. I'd like to return for a second, if I can, to the question of assassination, which Christopher was talking about a few moments ago. We're basically looking at whether any of these things would be an international crime, whether any other country in the world could prosecute Kissinger, because it's so unlikely that a U.S. court would actually convict him. That's the real issue here. And for the purpose of political assassination, there is only one time that it's an international crime. There is something called the International Protected Persons Convention that applies to current officials while they're in office and while they're abroad. And it says if you kill them or target them, that's an international crime and any country can prosecute. Now, the cases that we've been talking about don't involve current officials and don't involve them abroad. Letelier wasn't a current official at the time, even though he was abroad. I understand that Gerald Ford, after all of this came to light, enacted Executive Order 12333 that, on its face, prohibits U.S. entities and officials from engaging or supporting in assassinations. But what most people don't know about that is that it has been interpreted not to apply to most modern-day assassination attempts by the United States. For instance, when we purposely bombed Gaddafi's house in 1986, there was a memo by the Pentagon saying, well, that's outside the scope of the executive order. When we purposely tried to kill Saddam Hussein in the 1991 bombing raids, and most recently when we tried to bomb Slobodan Milosevic's residence in 1999, all of those times there were memos in the Department of Defense saying that that's not covered. I want to tell you, I have a close personal friend who's a senior military lawyer in the Department of Defense, and he jokes with me that his colleagues call international law I-law, and they're not really referring to international when they talk about I. They're referring to invisible. And I think what that indicates is that although in some areas international law is a very strongly defined deterrent and is a very good basis for prosecution, in many areas, and especially as concerns some of the allegations against Kissinger, we're talking about areas where the international law is very undefined, and therefore it's more or less invisible law.
But here, I think you're asking for a more rigorous standard of proof even than I am, because, I mean, you don't have to say, look, you've murdered this person, but unfortunately he doesn't qualify as this kind of official in that kind of place. No, hold it right there. Wait a minute. What was the word I just used? You've murdered this person. That's already a crime.
Okay. Right.
Let's lose sight of the obvious. One wouldn't have to prove that Kissinger was a war criminal or had committed crimes against humanity in order to prove that he was responsible for commissioning a hit on a public figure in another country. And any more than I would have to prove that General Pinochet had violated any particularly arcane form of international law when he ordered the killing of two civilians in downtown Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1976. That's already illegal. You try it and see if you don't get caught and held for even thinking of the idea.
Let's move on. 1-800-423-8255 makes the war crimes connection with Christopher Hitchens. Michael is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm looking for some clarification. Many years ago, I remember, I believe it was when Mr. Kissinger was releasing his memoirs, his galley proofs were stolen and printed. This is on the section concerning Cambodia. And when the book was finally released, the information contained was very different from his galley proofs. Am I wrong about that?
I don't remember it. Do you, Christopher Hitchens?
I must say I don't remember it either.
I remember
and I sort of feel I would, but that's where one can make a big mistake.
I just remember seeing an article in the American press about how he had been derided for that by British journalists when he toured in England. I don't remember the details.
Well, I'll be happy to check it out for you, but I can't help you right now. A lot of this argument, incidentally, that we're having in Harper's Magazine with Kissinger and his defenders is about the availability of the record, however. When Kissinger left office, he took with him, very questionably, a very large part of the documentary record of the Nixon administration and of his own part in it. He's managed to hold on to that stuff by making an ostensible gift of it to the Library of Congress that can't be opened until after he's gone. There are a lot of people who think it would be actually very interesting to have a look at it right now, when it might tell us things that we need to know. And some of the material concerning Chile and the assassination attempts on American citizens, murders, I should say, of American citizens.
Christopher, to follow
by,
up...
By Kissinger's friends, is I believe, now under subpoena.
Christopher, to follow
Michael
up
Scharf.
On Michael's question, Christopher Hitchens, you say in your article that in one of the latest memoirs by Kissinger, he changed his conclusion based on what you suggest are fears for liability. Can you tell us more about what you're suggesting there?
Well, I have a videotape of a conversation that on the phone with his publisher in New York, which I reproduce verbatim because it simply shows that Henry Kissinger is very worried about his own liability. I mean, I happen to know that he's also told close friends of his that he worries now that he can't travel anymore. He doesn't even dare go to Europe in case he be held for questioning or perhaps indicted by a magistrate in France or Spain or Italy or in England, indeed, which I must say I think is very good news.
Michael Scharf, if you were his lawyer, would you be telling him to sort of hang around the house a bit here for a while or not? Is this a phantom danger?
You know, that's the big problem with the new emergence of universal jurisdiction. The U.S. is out there trying to get more and more countries to prosecute people like Pol Pot, Iraqi officials, and people from Rwanda, and at the same time, it's having this deterrent effect on our own officials. Libya, just last year, circulated at the U.N. an indictment for John Poindexter and Oliver North.
Yeah, Oliver North has been warned sort of to
be
careful.
And the U.S. executive branch sent a letter to Oliver North saying, you know, it's our opinion that it's not really safe for you to travel right now because of this Pinochet-type situation that could occur. I would assume, based on the Harper's Magazine and all of the interest now on a possible Kissinger indictment, that Kissinger probably would be wise to curtail his travel, especially to countries that aren't close allies of the United States.
1-800-423-8255, the War Crimes Connection. James is on the line.
Yes, hi, Chris. Thanks, as usual, a phenomenal show.
Thank you, James.
Mr. Hitchens, I want to thank you for bringing increasing attention to this issue of international justice, which has got overwhelming international support. I think the United States is kind of creating a crisis of legitimacy and aligning itself with China and Libya, for instance, and not supporting the International Criminal Court. I'm wondering, what are the real chances that something like this will change? And also, if Kissinger could face, if I'm not mistaken, the Pinochet case was a civil case brought by a Spanish judge and prosecutor, if that same thing couldn't be applied to Kissinger. And one last question for Mr. Scharf. We talked earlier about the issue of defining, targeting civilians and crossing over with military purpose of attacking the civilians. I think of cases like El Mozote and El Salvador and how that gets really vague in terms of who is coming up with those definitions. How can that be clarified to some degree as this process of international trial starts to proceed?
Michael Scharf, do you want to answer that one first?
Let me take all three of those in order, and then Christopher Hitchens can take a shot at it as well. The first was a reference to the International Criminal Court, and I want to just emphasize that in negotiating that statute, all of the countries in the world agreed that there should be no retroactive application. So when we have a new permanent International Criminal Court in about a year, it cannot have jurisdiction over Kissinger and others who committed crimes before its statute comes into force. With respect to clarifying the international law, the last part of it, this new International Criminal Court and the ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia, Rwanda, there's a new one for Sierra Leone and one from Cambodia coming online, and the national cases, which are sprouting up all over the place. Not only do we have Pinochet in Spain and Chile, but there's the Hussein Habre case, where Chad's exiled former dictator has been arrested, and his trial by Senegal is on hold pending appeal right now. But there are many other cases. There's a case by Belgium that went up to the International Court of Justice because Belgium had indicted Congo's foreign minister, a guy named Nimbasi. Sounds very similar to the Kissinger case, although this guy is an actual sitting foreign minister. And Congo said, hey, that's going to be an infringement of our sovereignty. So they took that case to the International Court of Justice, and the International Court of Justice said that the Belgium case could go forward. So with all of this precedent being generated in all of these different forums, we're going to hopefully have clarifications. On the other hand, since there are so many different forums, it's likely that different interpretations of the law are going to emerge, and that could even muddy the water even further.
Christopher Hitchens, it's your turn.
Well, actually, I thought that was an excellent reply and very, very clarifying. I would only add that though there are some paradoxes and contradictions and quite a lot of unevenness in this, what I think you can see emerging is gradually the construction of an international human rights law ethic. And it's I think, advanced far enough now for it to be appalling that Mr. Scharf can say, and that it be true, that we have to just assume that no American court would ever do its duty about the fact that this country is harboring one of the most wanted war criminals in the world. Must it be, in other words, Mr. Scharf, can I ask you to reconsider or reformulate that? Do we have to assume that there isn't enough civic or legal or human rights spirit or principle in this country for it not to be left to some group of Chilean volunteers or relatives of the tortured and disappeared to bring a civil suit against this man?
Well,
do we have to leave it to them?
Yeah. The problem is that every executive branch official who's in power, who's sitting in Henry Kissinger's shoes, is looking over their shoulder and saying, what decisions will I make in the next 4 or 8 years which potentially could bring me to an international court? And that's the kind of
thinking. What the pedagogic effect of justice is supposed to be. It's supposed to deter people from using their office to commit crime.
And absolutely, and perhaps...
Are you now saying the United States government couldn't survive that thought?
No, I'm not saying that. And obviously, when you have a case like Lieutenant Calley, who is an individual who commits an atrocious crime like the My Lai massacre, the U.S. rises to the occasion and will prosecute. But more often than not, the executive branch members close ranks and protect their own. And they do this because they're thinking about what might happen to them in the future. So the civil law avenue of bringing a private case then may become the most important and practical avenue available for U.S. justice.
Christopher Hitchens, are you suggesting that he be tried in this country, the man who...
I certainly think so, and I was listening rather open-mouthed at this idea that the judiciary was part of the executive branch while Mr. Scharf was talking, but I'm not a lawyer.
It's hard to imagine the W...
I'm not a lawyer, but I think I know that it's not. I don't see why it should be assumed that there is not enough legal principle adhering in this system for justice to be done right here.
Let's see. Christopher Hitchens, thank you enormously for joining us on The Connection, and thank you for the work in these pieces in Harper's Magazine in the February issue and March. Michael Scharf, thank you, from the New England School of Law. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.
This is W.